From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In the early 1960s, New Orleans was like any other city on the Gulf Coast. Hot, steamy, and segregated. But unlike most southern cities, New Orleans had a vibrant musical culture featuring some of the nation's best traditional jazz players. These African-American musicians became mentors to journalist Tom Sankton. Back then, Sankton was a boy, a white boy, who wanted to play clarinet.
But I really didn't think, and this may sound strange or quite condescending, but I thought at the time that white people could not play, like they could not have that sound and spirit.
Tom Sankton is now a mighty fine clarinet player. His memoir about training with musicians at Preservation Hall is an important historical record of New Orleans in the 1960s. Tom Sankton, after the break. In the history of Western civilization, only a few careers have afforded people free movement, geographically, between social classes, and across the color line. Journalists, academics, and artists have long enjoyed a kind of mobility that allows them to roam in ways that others historically have not. Tom Sankton hit a professional trifecta. Sankton spent more than 20 years as a reporter and editor at Time magazine. He was a Rhodes Scholar and earned a Ph.D. in history at Oxford University. And he's a clarinet player, schooled by some of the best traditional jazz musicians that New Orleans has ever produced. That's him playing now. What else? High society. Like many clarinet players, here and elsewhere, Sankton is a disciple of George Lewis, whose musical pedigree placed him within easy distance of the earliest jazz heroes, such as Bunk Johnson and Buddy Bolden. George Lewis died in 1968, but there are clarinet players right now, right this second, trying to emulate his tone. Sankton has released more than a dozen albums, but perhaps his most precious contribution to music has been as an author. Sankton wrote a memoir about the years he spent with the last generation of musicians who introduced, then reintroduced, traditional jazz to the world. It's called Song for My Fathers, a New Orleans story in black and white. Tom Sankton joins us here at Marini Recording Studios. So do we call you Tom or Tommy?
Probably Tom. Probably Tom. I'm a bit of a kind of a schizophrenic personality. Not really, but Tom is more my professional name and my kind of personal name. Musically, it's Tommy because I was Tommy when I started out as a little 12-year-old kid.
Okay, well we will respect your adulthood and call you Tom. Okay. So journalists, academics, and artists are people who are generally on the outside looking in. Is that a feeling that you've had since a young age?
Well, as a journalist, it was very much a position of an observer, not so much a participant in what I was reporting on. As a musician, I started out very much on the outside looking in. When I was first taken to Preservation Hall by my dad in 1962, I was 12 years old. I guess I just turned 13. And it was an amazing experience. I'd never seen or heard anything like that. And in fact, and this was still under the Jim Crow regime. And so white people and black people really didn't socialize. And I didn't have much access to or much chance to observe African Americans in their element doing their thing. And so very much I felt like an outsider, not uncomfortably so. I just felt like I was observing something that I wasn't really part of.
And so we should say that these were the early years of Preservation Hall. I think the hall opened in 1961, I want to say.
61, this way, and then June 61, and my first visit there was June 62.
And Preservation Hall was sort of riding this wave of renewed national interest in traditional jazz.
I think you could say it launched that wave. And well, not it. The wave had actually started with the rediscovery of Bunk Johnson in the early 40s. And Bunk Johnson had taught Louis Armstrong. Bunk Johnson had, or claimed to have, played with Buddy Bolden. So he was really one of the first generation of jazz musicians. And he was sort of rediscovered after quitting music for 15 years or so, and recorded in 1942. Well, those recordings launched an interest in reviving traditional jazz. But I think in terms of traditional jazz being an active, living, performed music in a venue in New Orleans, I think Preservation Hall really had so much to do with launching that the sort of international interest in traditional jazz. So that was right at the beginning of this very important chapter in the history of American music, really.
This is a perfect introduction for you to this world of music and musicians, you know, who would ultimately keep you company well into your adult years.
Yes, yes. It was. It was an unexpected introduction. My father was the editor of the New Republic for some years and wrote lots of incendiary articles denouncing segregation. And so from that point of view, he was very much attuned to the importance of racial equality in the African-American culture. You know, I think he thought it was interesting to expose me to this, and also he loved that music. And so he was very excited to discover Preservation Hall and wanted to bring me there. And so it was a very interesting introduction to the music and the culture, but also to a part of New Orleans it was that I hadn't really experienced at that age, the French Quarter. I mean, there were a lot of French Quarter characters who hung around Preservation Hall or around the, either in the hall or around it. There were the musicians, of course, but there were, I guess what in those days you still call beatniks. There were local people. It was very much an artistic world. It was an adult world. And again, for me, this was not something that I had experienced earlier.
It's true. But at the same time, what's fascinating about the Tom Sankton story is that you were fording so many different social circles all at the same time. I mean, as you say, your father was an integrationist. But at the same time, I mean, your mother, who was a librarian at Tulane, you know, she was the daughter of a Supreme Court justice, wasn't she, in Mississippi?
A Mississippi Supreme Court, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is sort of within one family.
Well, it was, yes, it was.
Very different walks of life.
My father was from a working class background, the first in his family to go to college. My mother came from a very well-to-do family in Jackson, Mississippi. What he brought to this family was very much his convictions. I never had any inkling that my mother didn't share those convictions, but it was certainly very different from the ideas that she grew up with in Jackson, Mississippi, in kind of an elite social circle.
In the Jim Crow South.
Yeah, exactly.
And so your father stepped away from his journalism to write novels.
Right, right.
And which you talk about in your memoir, Song for My Fathers. So tell us what your household sounded like when you were a kid.
Sounded like a manual typewriter. when I was very young, I would go to bed, actually go to sleep in his bed, and he worked in his bedroom. And I would hear the clatter of his Underwood number 5 typewriter until I went to sleep. It was my lullaby. Maybe people today don't really know what that sounds like. The younger people, they know what a computer keyboard sounds like.
I think you can get an app that can make your computer sound like an Underwood.
Well, that's what the sound was in our household. We're talking about now the mid to late 50s and early 60s. My sisters loved Elvis Presley. They loved the Platters. And that was the kind of music they listened to. My mother listened to opera. My father was not somebody who would go to the record player and just sit down and listen to music, although he loved it. He was very busy during those years working on his novels. That's the world I first remember.
That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad.
You didn't think you wanted to be a musician as a youngster until you heard George Lewis, the great clarinetist, play.
Yeah.
And I'd love it if you could give us a little reading from your book.
Sure.
When you describe that,
yeah,
that moment.
Let me see, page 54, yeah. I don't know if I had ever felt passion before, that pulse-churning excitement that makes you want to possess a thing, to fuse with it and have it fuse with you, that makes that thing seem greater and more wonderful than any other thing in the world. That's what I felt for the sound of George Lewis's clarinet.
And you were 13.
13, just turned 13.
And had just been exposed to passion, or at least realized that passion could come out of you.
I don't think I'd ever felt that just all embracing desire for something.
And so do you remember what George Lewis was playing at the time?
Oh, yes, very well. He was playing his famous composition, the Burgundy Street Blues. And it was his iconic tune. And I say composition, I don't think he ever wrote down a note of music, but he must have recorded it 50 times. It was just angelic. The sound of his clarinet was angelic. The tone, the soul, the spirit, and I was just enthralled by that. It was soul and spirit and something almost holy in some kind of non-sectarian sense.
It is not easy to play a clarinet.
No, it's not.
Talk about that.
Well, by the time I encountered George Lewis at age 13, I didn't quite think that it was something I could do.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I had a desire to do it, but I really didn't think, and this may sound strange or not quite condescending, but I think I thought at the time that white people could not play, like they could not have that much sound and spirit. And, you know, I just didn't think a young white kid could embody all of that. Well, I heard and met a wonderful young English clarinet player named Sammy Remington, who was visiting, and he had learned George Lewis's style from playing his records and copying his records. And he sat in with George Lewis at Preservation Hall, and I was just completely blown away because he sounded just like George. And so I said, well, you know, if a young white guy from England, you know, can do this, maybe I can. When he went back to England, he sent me one of his old clarinets. And that's how I started taking lessons with George Lewis. And that's how I began to encounter the clarinet, the mechanics of it, the difficulties of it.
Yeah, it's a reed instrument. Reeds are difficult. The sound doesn't come out the bell just like it would in with a trumpet. It sounds comes out of someplace else, other magical place. And, you know, so tell us about how to get a sound out of a clarinet. How hard is it? And, you know, and what was your first victory?
Okay, well, I don't know if there was a precise moment, but certainly when we got the reeds and I wet them, as George Lewis had shown me, put it on the clarinet, and I blew into it, and instead of just a hissing noise, I actually got a note. And I think that was certainly a turning point. It was a good start. And when I first started to be able to play recognizable melodies, that was exciting. And the tone is so important on the clarinet, particularly if you're trying to play a style like this that's very expressive, that has a lot of emotion and feeling in it, a lot of your breath is your life, isn't it? You breathe and that's what keeps you alive. And when you're breathing into an instrument, it's really an extension of your own
life force.
Yeah. And so the experience of having your breath go from your lungs, you know, through your throat and into this instrument and come out as sound, you know, that's just, it's an extraordinary experience.
This is Tom Sankton and his Crescent City Serenaders with Smiles, a song from the album Louisiana Fairy Tale. Coming up, when mixing between the races was against the law in New Orleans, civil disobedience never sounded so good. Tom Sankton breaks the law. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In the 1960s, Tom Sankton wanted to play clarinet like New Orleans musician George Lewis. But Tom Sankton grew up to sound just like Tom Sankton. Thank you.
You sound good, Tom Sankton. Nice to meet you.
You should have heard George Lewis.
But there is definitely a difference. As you say, a tone is a personal thing. It's an individual's life force.
Yeah.
And even though you are strongly influenced by George Lewis, you can't possibly have his tone completely.
If only. it's maybe a little less guts out, you know, a little less overtly emotional, but very much, I hope, a feeling of the blues, what the blues is, you know, but done in a way that's somewhat more reserved.
Yeah. And so, you know, in your book and of course in person, you've said that the one thing you really didn't want to do as a young person is to sound like a white boy.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is it's a tough topic, but this is something that comes up in music, you know? And so what does sounding like a white boy mean in the context of this kind of music, traditional jazz?
Yeah, on the clarinet. Well, let me just qualify that by saying that there have been some white boys who were phenomenal clarinet players and defined whole schools of clarinet style. Obviously, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, Buddy DeFranco in a more bebop vein. So it has nothing to do with musical ability. But to me, in general, what a white clarinet player or white, say, Dixieland musician would sound like is it's technical. I think the tone, in my perception, would be kind of a little thinner, shriller. I guess. I don't know.
I don't know either. It's fascinating. And you know, every time I think to myself, I can listen to music and I can tell the difference. I'm almost always wrong. You know, or at least I'm wrong a good 50% of the time.
There's been so much cross-pollination and so many influences going, you know, back and forth that you really can't. It's a gross caricature, but that's kind of what I felt when I was starting out in the music.
Sure, and you were apprenticing with a particular group of musicians, you know, who were giving you very interesting advice. I mean, race is an important theme in your book, and you know, and in your upbringing as a musician, and you know, the bass player Chester's Artist, who played with Preservation Hall for so long. I mean, he tells you straight out, you know, that you must be with black musicians in order to play well.
Do you
believe that?
Well, in my experience, I think it was very important for me to not just listen to and learn from black musicians, but to also have them hear me and to get their feedback, you know, which I got a lot of that. I played a lot with Harold Dejean's Olympia Brass Band and parades and funerals and stuff, and they'd tell me, well, you know, don't overblow, and then, you know, you got to pace yourself on a long parade and things like that. So having their reaction to what I was doing was very important.
And also, it seems to me that there's something about, you know, integrating the rhythm of how these fellas move and think and talk, you know? And these are guys who, let's face it, I mean, many of them are elderly or very close to elderly at the time that you're, you know, learning from them. So their pace, you know what I mean, in walking and talking and playing is going to be so much different from the pace of a teenager.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's a very important point. Bunk Johnson used to say in New Orleans, you don't play faster than you can walk. You know, and in New Orleans, it gets very hot.
It's so wise, yeah.
So the tempos, the real traditional tempos are not all that fast. And it's true that these guys, they moved more slowly. And some of them, I mean, they were, the age I am now, but seemed very elderly then, and it doesn't seem so much now. But that was another aspect of this experience, because I always say that the book, Song for My Fathers, it deals with music, but it's not about music per se. I always say it's about people coming together over barriers. That's really what it's about. And the barriers are what? They're racial barriers, economic barriers, class barriers.
Yes.
and generational barriers.
Yes.
Because for a 13-year-old to be hanging around with, worshiping, learning from, and laughing with, and eating with, and, you know, playing parades with guys in their 60s and 70s and sometimes 80s or even 90s.
Sure.
This was an exceptional thing.
You know, it's funny you should say that because I don't know if people have a strong understanding of what the law said at that time,
yeah.
You know, in terms of the Jim Crow era South. But in some ways, you know, it's fair to say that you and your dad were breaking the law.
Oh, absolutely.
Every dang day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for breaking the segregation laws. You could not socialize under the same roof. Now, a black person could be in your house as a domestic servant or carpenter or something. Blacks and whites could be together in Preservation Hall. The band could be black because they were hired help. Let's face it, they were hired help. But mixing in any social way, in any personal human way, was technically against the law. Now all that ended with the Civil Rights Act in 1964. But my experience with this started in 1962. So for 2 years. Every time I went to George Lewis's house, or he came to our house, or we'd sneak into Buster's restaurant on Orleans and Burgundy. And
Buster Holmes?
Yeah, Buster Holmes. He'd eat his red beans with the other musicians. And it was all technically against the law. You know, people, younger people today, they don't know this, or they can't believe it, or it just seems like something from the, you know, Civil War era or something. But no, this is the way it was.
The way it
I
was.
But you don't believe it. You're too young.
No. I remember a lot. And but the thing is, and what people also fail to understand is that just because a federal law has been signed,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It doesn't mean that things are changing in individual states, you know.
Right, like look at Obamacare, for example.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
But you
tell this very interesting story about Dora Bliggen.
Yeah, yeah.
In Song for My Fathers.
Right.
And this is a woman who sold blackberries.
Yeah, Dora Bliggen was one of the many street vendors who used to just kind of crisscross the streets of New Orleans in those days.
And she was a black woman.
She was a black woman from the country. And she would come down the street. She had a big kind of a straw basket, and she carried it like an African woman, you know, on her head. And she had a street cry. And there were lots of vendors in those days. I remember people who sold alligator pears. You know, alligator, the ice man would come by. And with mule-drawn wagons, you know. But anyway, Dora was on foot. And a man named Frederick Ramsey, he was doing field recordings in the music of the South. And he knew my father from my father's New York years. And my father said, well, this is wonderful street vendor, and she comes by here every afternoon around 4 or whatever. And sure enough, around 4 o'clock, you could hear her coming from the distance. And Fred Ramsey, I remember his eyes just lit up, and he was saying, oh, this is marvelous. Then they went down and they bought all of her blackberries. And so they asked her if she would come up and record a thing. And she was a little reticent to do it because, again, you know, it's the segregation laws, and she didn't have any business in that house. No, but my parents invited her up, and she stood in the living room, and I remember standing next to her, and she was standing up and sweating and had the microphone on a stand in front of her, and I still listen to the recording today. This came out on a Folkways recording and since has been reissued on Smithsonian Records. And it's a wonderful, chilling piece of history.
Dora Bliggen was also a gospel singer. On the day she sang her Blackberry song at the Sanctons' house, Tom Sancton remembers that she recorded other songs as well, including On a Monday Morning.
Holy, holy, holy. Holy, 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 somebody taught me. and they must have been the handsome below. Turn on the Sunday morning, somebody taught me. On the Sunday morning, somebody taught me. On the Sunday morning, somebody taught me. And they must have been the handsome below. Lord, Lord, somebody taught me. Lord, 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 somebody taught me. And it must have been the hands of the Lord. Whew. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord.
On a Monday Morning by Dora Bliggan. Coming up, seeing the world through Creole eyes. Stay tuned. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're talking with traditional jazz clarinet player Tom Sankton. In 2006, he published a memoir about his experiences as a young white apprentice to veteran African-American musicians playing at Preservation Hall. Song for My Fathers, a New Orleans story in black and white, features lessons from the 1960s. Sankton writes that he learned a lot more than music from his mentors. Banjo player George Gaino made sure he was conversant in Creole heritage. Gaino describes Creoles as unlike any other demographic in New Orleans.
Considered neither white nor Negro, this outstanding group, a race within a race, with a fierce pride of their heritage and birthright, produced some of the most stalwart, outstanding, and respected citizens of the day. Among them were to be found some of the most beautiful women in the world. They were white and coral and brown. You never saw women so pretty in all your life. And the envy of both the whites and the blacks.
The envy of both the whites and the blacks.
Yeah.
And also, he's making this distinction that this is a third race.
Yeah, very much. As he says, a race within a race. And this is just part of the racial and sociological reality of New Orleans. There are hierarchies of within the black side or the colored side of the line. It wasn't just skin tone. That was the most obvious thing. It was what is the background of somebody with a French-sounding name who's lighter-skinned as opposed to somebody who is darker, has more of an English-sounding name, an American-sounding name. I'm not really telling you anything you don't know. Probably most of your listeners know something about this story, but the Creoles of color, free people of color, were mixed-race people who had, in most cases, some French background or French and Spanish, or some mixture, and they were very proud of it. And many of them were educated. And the darker-skinned people were what? Well, they were the descendants of slaves, and many of them were not educated. And the Creoles did not want to be lumped in with them.
Right. Under the colonial governments, the French especially, the Code Noir, mm-hmm. the law, mm-hmm. you mean they recognized this category.
Right.
You know what I mean? Of free people of
right.
color and all. But when the Americans came, things changed in this state.
Right. Right. All of a sudden, these free people of color, the Creoles, they're lumped in with the poorer blacks, and they didn't like it. Not necessarily because they thought it was unfair for white people to discriminate against colored people in general. It's that they didn't want to have to be lumped in with the what they called the Americans.
This is a lot to lay on a kid,
yeah.
on a,
oh, but, I mean, George
white
Gaino.
Teenager, what, 14, 15 years old?
Yeah, but I was fascinated. I was fascinated. George Gaino, he explained all that kind of thing to me. Not in so much academic terms, but in terms of certainly his attitudes, and you heard it on that tape right there. He would say, you know, he'd put a stocking on his head to have his, you know, he had wavy hair and he had
silky.
His pomade. You know.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, you know, people, a lot of musicians wouldn't, you know, the Creole musicians wouldn't talk to anybody that didn't have silky hair.
Yeah.
So there was that kind of discrimination, you know, within the so-called colored community.
Right. And so in terms of how this presented itself within the community of musicians you knew, those who were playing traditional jazz, you know, many Creole jazz musicians, you know, were formally trained, could read music, could write music, mm-hmm. and all this sort of thing. And yet there were others, you know, who were non-Creole black musicians, like George Lewis, for instance, who were not formally trained.
One of the factors in the that contributed to the development of jazz is this the mixture of what each of these groups brought into it, the more kind of the American untrained musicians brought spontaneity, they brought rhythm, they brought some kind of force and power
and improvisation
into the music, whereas the Creoles brought precision, they brought correct technique. They brought, as I say, a certain aspect to European repertoires and things like that. And you put that all together and you get some very interesting results.
Absolutely. You know? And Then it works out in terms of some type of collaboration that it results in usually something greater than both sides.
Right, definitely. I think that's exactly what happened. D.D. Pierce, wonderful blind trumpet player with his wife, Billy. They were Creoles. He spoke, you know, fluent Creole French. Did a number of the musicians I knew, and he played in a band that had Jim Robinson on
the trombone.
Who's a dark-skinned trombone player who grew up on a plantation, probably born in what had been a slave cabin, born in the 1880s. Cy Fraser on the drums, who was not a Creole. Sometimes they'd have Norvin Kimball on the banjo, who was not a Creole, but he was trained. And when they were all together on the bandstand, they were actually just jazz musicians, New Orleans jazz musicians. They played beautifully together.
As people who've grown up on rock and roll and soul music and rap music and all of the, you know, I mean, all the modern genres that talk specifically about rebellion or unhappiness or social, you know, I mean,
or violence,
tension or violence. Yeah. It's unusual to come across a kind of music in which personal pain and frustration never overtake the music.
Right. The music that we're talking about really was almost like a haven from all that.
It kind of was, yeah. I mean, what I find is that traditional jazz has, you know, a very interesting balancing act because it's one of the few musical genres in which secular and spiritual music are in complete balance. Mm-hmm. And so it seems as if perhaps some of that pain you know, yeah. that so many of these musicians might have been feeling, or the pressure, yeah. societal pressures that they were feeling, came out in their renditions of spirituals and hymns. Yeah. You did a whole album of hymns and spirituals.
I think it's, I think what you said just now is absolutely on the mark. And I think it's the hymns and spirituals are very much part of the repertoire of traditional jazz. And I think they do express faith, some kind of solace and hope and spirituality, but it's not separated from the other music. It's all part of a continuum. I've always enjoyed playing the hymns and spirituals.
Well, you know, Marini Recording Studio is, I mean, we're in an old bar. I mean, this ain't no church, right?
Yeah, right.
But that is not going to stop me from asking you to play a spiritual or hymn.
All right.
What would you like to play?
I think maybe the Old Rugged Cross.
That's a beautiful song. Oh,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right.
Gorgeous.
Thank you.
But let's talk about greatness.
Greatness.
It's a subject that music critics are obsessed with. Mm. You know, who's great, who's just okay, who's good. And, you know, and it also propelled, I don't know if you ever saw it, but it propelled the action in an Oscar-nominated film called Whiplash,
which was
about, you know, jazz musicians, modern jazz musicians. Yeah. What is the difference between good and great? In your mind?
I think it's very difficult to establish any kind of set criteria. I think what I would consider great about George Lewis's playing, certainly the boot camp sergeant who passed for a band director in that movie you mentioned, he'd laugh at George Lewis. He'd laugh at George Lewis. You know, it's funny. I was talking about that movie with Jason Marsalis the other day.
Ah, the great drummer and vibraphonist.
Now, he's great. Right? So, and he has technique to burn, and all the stuff that you saw in the drum technique in the movie, he can do all that and more. But he said, you know, what really struck me was that nobody in that band seemed to be having any fun playing music.
Thank you.
In my experience, I've never seen anything like that. Anybody who approached teaching music like that. You know, I've never taught music, but I've taught creative writing, you know, which is trying to nurture people who are trying to improvise, create, be artists and, you know, as writers, and to try to encourage them and guide them, but certainly not break their spirits. Now, as to what greatness is, it's really like, it's a matter of taste. I mean, some people achieve so-called greatness because they're recognized. But I think George Lewis and many of the people that I heard were great musicians. They were great human beings. They were great artists. They were great exponents of a great cultural tradition that many other people would not recognize as great.
Right.
Wouldn't even make it onto their radar screen.
Let me ask you this. I mean, is it true that all great musicians are mama's boys?
Well, a lot of them were. A lot of these musicians that I knew, George Lewis was definitely, Jim Robinson was, Punch Miller was. I mean, the way I know this is the way they talked. They all talked about their mothers, and George Gaynor too. It's an interesting thing. They all talked about their mothers as somebody who they loved and who had a lot of influence on them. And my father always thought that's where a lot of their sensitivity came from, was the impact of their mothers on their lives.
Well, before we say goodbye, I'm going to give you an option. Do you want to leave on a song that you want to dedicate to your mom or to your fathers?
Well, I've dedicated a lot to my fathers. I'll dedicate something to my mother, sure. I don't talk a lot about her in the book, but she was definitely part of that whole experience, and she loved the musicians, and she was a real, personage in that whole circle of fans and musicians around Preservation Hall. Oh, what am I going to play? I want to play "Girl of My Dreams." I love you.
Oh, that's a beautiful one. Well, thank you so much, Tom Sankton.
Thank you.
Author,
thank you.
Journalist.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Clarinet player extraordinaire.
Thank you.
My Dreams, dedicated to Sita Sankton, Tom Sankton's mother. Tom is a journalist, clarinet player, and author. His book, Song for My Fathers, A New Orleans Story in Black and White, is now available as an interactive ebook. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Steve Panacek, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the songs on this broadcast and more information about Tom Sankton and his latest book, The Betancourt Affair, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also received support from the Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.